Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call Monday? We call Monday Rethink the Week. When do we tape Monday? We tape Monday on Friday morning. We've been spending a lot of time talking about Project 2025, and we will continue to do that on Tuesday. But I got a poem in from Lynn Ekdahl, our political poet, and I thought, you know, let me share it. Every time she writes her poetry, I feel like I need to sort of justify her raison d'être and her reason for existence, because she writes such great stuff, and I want to make sure that as many people get a chance to hear it. So Lynn Ekdahl's poem is entitled John Roberts Meets Roger Taney. It may sound quite odd, and it does seem uncanny, the Roberts Court looking like that of Judge Taney, both courts determined to deny basic rights, both courts igniting backlash and long fights. The Dred Scott decision, dreadful, unique, was issued as white supremacy peaked, saying blacks had no right of citizenship. It consigned them to slaves, the dogs and the whips. Abe's 13th Amendment erased Taney's stain, though plenty of racist expression remained. Now Roberts and friends seek to roll back the clock, help limit the vote as their voting rights mock. And they have a new target they have in their sights, women's, especially poor women's rights. The Roberts Court says there's no right to abortion. Unless you've got options, try access to a fortune. Alito and Thomas would like to do more. They're suggesting the Comstock laws to restore. These prohibit abortion meds sent in the mail and will put those who mail mifepristone in jail. We've seen it before. This is backlash to progress. The dominant caste wants to halt the whole process. The battle's engaged, human rights or repression, and as in the past, will block social regression. Boy, Lynn Ekdahl, I am totally impressed with you. Joining us right now for a Rethink the Week is our panel of guests. New to the Rethink the Week is Alexandria Jacobson. She's an investigative reporter who joined Raw Story in 2023 with an extensive track record of social justice, education, consumer affairs, healthcare, tech, and data science reporting, which makes you perfect for Rethink the Week. Her reporting has been published by numerous national outlets, including ABC News, Chicago Sun-Times, Chicago Tribune, The Chicago Reporter. Jacobson's investigative work has been recognized with the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award and a Peter Lissagor Award, and she recently earned first place prizes from the Chicago Journalists Association, the National Federation of Press Women, and the Illinois Women's Press Association. Well, welcome to the program, Alexandria. Thank you so much for participating.
Great to be here.
It's a pleasure. Lincoln Mitchell teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. He is the author of 8 books, and his writings have appeared at CNN, Reuters, the New York Times, NBC, the San Francisco Examiner, and numerous other media platforms. If you want more of Lincoln's work, you can subscribe to his Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Mitchell.
Always good to wrap up my Friday, my week with you and the gang. Oh,
it's a pleasure. Stephen Pimpare is now a professor of public policy at Vermont Law and Graduate School. He is the author of 4 books, including A People's History of Poverty, and most recently, Politics for Social Workers, A Practical Guide to Effecting Change. Welcome to the program, Stephen. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Arnie. Good to be here.
I spent a lot of time on the Friday show. I'll spend more time on Monday, but there are so many economic numbers coming out everywhere. And I started on Friday by talking about the Forbes list of billionaires. And the Forbes list of billionaires is not shocking, but wicked depressing. And in part, it's depressing because not only are there 141 more billionaires this year than last year, but there are a record number of 2,781 billionaires. But this is the kicker. They are collectively richer. That means that they are rich by how much more? They are richer by $2 trillion more than 2023. Not that they control $2 trillion. They are just $2 trillion richer, richer, everyone. And I'm like, oh my God, oh my God. And as I'm looking at this, people are saying, really? And how many more people are in poverty? That's what people are asking me. They're giving us the billionaire numbers. What about the poor people numbers? But then I decided I would do something quirky. And I thought, let me look at the middle class, because, you know, we always focus on the middle class. And here was an interesting statistic from Pew. The U.S. middle class has been shrinking over the past 50 years. About 50% are now considered in the middle class today in America, compared to 61% in 1971. All right. So I think we have to keep putting these numbers into context because we don't tend to do that. And then finalmente, I put the following up. And this came from the Economic Policy Institute. And it's a good news story, but it's a suck story. Okay. All right. So here's the good news story. After decades of slow growth, Black and Hispanic workers experience faster wage growth. All right, now, so have that in your head, and let me verbally describe the graphs to you. So they looked at 1979 to 2019, a 10-year period, and then they looked at 2019 to 2023, only a 4-year period. From 1979 to 2019, over an entire decade, Blacks saw income growth of 0.3%, Hispanics saw income growth of 0.3%, and whites saw income growth of 0.5. So over that 10-year period, whites did better than Blacks and Hispanics. Now let me go to 2019 to 2023. Here's where the numbers really rock your socks. Blacks saw an income growth of 1.4%, Hispanics 0.9%, and whites stay level at 0.5. All right. So I posted that and everyone's like, whoa. But then I asked the following question. Where did they start? All right, everyone. Where did Blacks start when it came to income? Where did Hispanics start? Where did whites start? That's my first question. But then Stephen was so smart and he said, but Arnie, it's not, actually, that's, it was, both of you were smart, but Lincoln said to me, but Arnie, really, we shouldn't be looking at income. We should be looking at wealth. And you both would have said the same thing to me. And so I, of course, went there. I'm so good. And Brookings pointed out that Black wealth is increasing. Oh, wow. I'm so excited. But so is the racial wealth gap, all right? So once again, we can't just look at numbers in isolation. We have to look at them in perspective. And since Lincoln, you said to me, but Arnie, we can't look at wages, we have to look at wealth. I want to bring this into the conversation because, you know, I'm listening to Morning Joe, I'm listening to CNN, and they're talking about the fact that why can't Joe Biden get any credit for the great economy? Look at wages. Wages have gone up by 4.1%. Inflation's only gone up by 3.2%. Why isn't he getting recognized for this? All this kind of stuff. Look at the stock market. Look at the jobs he's creating, especially in the Rust Belt, yada, yada, yada. And as I'm looking at all this, I think the problem is we haven't looked at sort of the beginning point, which are points of despair. You know, people that didn't have wage increases, people that didn't access healthcare, people that didn't be able to get an affordable home, people that didn't be able to, you know, put food on their table. And so the fact is that if things are getting better, if we don't understand the arc of change, we're not going to understand why a lot of people aren't feeling it. Because even if things are getting better, they still, like the racial wealth gap, are beginning to understand, yes, things are increasing, but the gap is getting bigger, wrote Lincoln.
I'm going to try to answer what I think is some very important questions that you raise by trying to bring this together. Mm-hmm. What you touched upon is what feels like a permanent, or might be called a permanent, state of economic dissatisfaction.
Yes.
Because the macro trends are so concerning that no matter what the micro trend is, what the last few years have been, people don't feel great about the economy. You know, now, right. Donald Trump, who has a relationship to the truth, to truth telling that charitably could be called non-existent, boasts about having created the greatest economy ever. And if you are deeply, deeply in that cult, you might believe that, but the rest of America doesn't. So we are with the trend is slowly moving down the hill. So this Carvillian notion that it's the economy, stupid, which was true, you know, in 1992, when a lot of American voters weren't even born yet, is no longer relevant because the economy is kind of always bad. But I want to go back to a data point that you raised among the many data points that for me really capture why this is, really capture the heart of this. You said that today 50% of Americans are considered middle class, and that at some point in the past that number was 61. And if we go back further, it was probably higher. But what that data doesn't capture is what it means to be middle class. A generation or two ago, what it meant to be middle class was that you didn't live in fear of not being able to make the rent or your mortgage, that you weren't looking ahead if you were 30 or 40 years old at a lifetime of debt because of the education you had to get to have a decent job, that you didn't live in fear of getting sick because it not only could bankrupt you, but could bankrupt your kids and or your parents. So fewer people are middle class, and middle class doesn't mean what it used to. As I've said before on this show, if, and I'm going to use rough numbers here, and our listeners are free to dispute or disagree on the exact numbers, but the gist of what I'm saying is true. If you were born in the United States between 1935 and 1980, you were born into a middle-class country. And that meant certain assumptions. It meant certain, it was a very positive thing. It also meant that you weren't, that extraordinary wealth, billionaires weren't flaunting their wealth all the time and telling you they had the answers. But if you were born after 1980, you're not born into a middle-class country. And that brings with it this state of permanent economic dissatisfaction, permanent economic concern, and overlaid with billionaires who, like I said, think they have all the answers, and they do if the question is, how can me and my friends get richer?
And so, Alexandra, as I'm listening to this, there's another conversation that was going on this morning about the gap between men and women. And it's the political gap, it's the resentment gap, it's all these things. It's, you know, how many women are now suddenly accessing higher education and men are not? How many men are not seeing, you know, opportunities and doors opening and women are? And it was talking about this gap. And the reason I even bring up the resentment and the change, and we were talking about this before, Stephen Pimpare, about the fact that affirmative action, everyone, when they think of affirmative action, they think of a Black and Hispanic, and the door is open for a Black and Hispanic. And it turns out that affirmative action was successful, but it was successful for one particular group, white women. Okay. I just want people to know this. But Alexandra, as I was quoting some of those numbers, I want to go back to the middle class number. And that is, and you're young, I'm old. Okay. And that's why it's a good conversation between the two of us, that in 1971, when it was 61% of Americans that were able to be considered middle class versus the 50% today, do you know what was also true in 1971? It took one wage earner to get you into middle class. So not only is there resentment, okay, about where we are as a middle class today, but what do you know, Alexandra, and I know it from my daughters, not only does it take two incomes, or maybe even sometimes two and a half incomes, to produce what was possible with one income, but what happens when you are living in a nuclear family, so one set of grandparents is in one state, one is in another state, and you are living somewhere else, and if you have to go to work, there's another financial obligation you didn't have in 1971. Who the frick takes care of the kids? Who's going to pay for the daycare? Who's going to make that? Who's going to absorb that? How do we convince schools to go from half-day kindergarten to full-day kindergarten? Because kindergarten isn't just kindergarten. It's actually a form of daycare. All right. So I think, again, as we even look at these numbers, it's not just wages. It's not just the number of people that are now in the workforce. It's the cost of going to work, Alexandria, that nobody ever talks about. Going to work is not cheap.
Absolutely. And so I was born in the early 90s, and, you know, my peers and I, you know, everything you just said is exactly the sentiment that I'm constantly hearing. It's, yes, you know, in order to have home ownership, you need two incomes. How are we going to have kids and afford daycare and, you know, have jobs, et cetera? So I think that, you know, even though the numbers show in the economy that, hey, last year, you know, the GDP grew by more than 3%, you know, that's great. Like, all these great numbers for Joe Biden are there, but I think it's not matching up with the way people are feeling and experiencing their lives, that we can't achieve these middle-class milestones that we saw our parents be able to achieve without extreme sacrifice and going into debt for our education, and not to mention bigger home loans and things like that. So that's a constant thing I hear among my peers. And I think, you know, just kind of across the board, people that aren't, you know, super, super wealthy, I think that's just a constant line that we're hearing.
Well, and so, Stephen, I want to talk about the fact that you were talking about how well the GDP is doing and everyone is saying this. And I want to go back to the billionaire number. Okay, we know the U.S. has the highest number of billionaires in the world. And people are saying, oh, Arnie, are you resenting billionaires? I'm going, no, I'm not resenting billionaires. But what I also want to remind everyone was, not only do we have more billionaires, but how much wealthier are the billionaires? $2 trillion. No one has done the math for me, but how much of that GDP went to the billionaires? I'm kind of curious, you know, I mean, as we look at all these numbers, everyone throws them out, but no one gives us the sort of the underbelly numbers that explain why there is this resentment, why there are so many more billionaires. How do we define success? And then I'm looking at, for example, on Easter Sunday in Florida, and I'll end up going back to you, Alexandria, but I'm gonna go to Stephen. On Easter Sunday, they threw off all these kids off of Medicaid on Easter Sunday. So I want to hear how well things are going in this country. But on Easter Sunday, if you're a parent whose kid was covered by Medicaid, boy, Easter Sunday sucked. I'm just telling you right now. And again, that's part of the problem. Look at the lives that people are experiencing, and they are lives of insecurity and instability.
And none of that is some sort of natural consequence. That is all the result of what is now 50 or 60 years worth of aggressive mobilization by wealthy interests to move away from the relatively modest inroads that were made in expanding well-being more broadly across the population in the post-war period. You mentioned earlier, Arnie, the 2025 project from the Heritage Foundation. And you also talked about sort of, we start to see these numbers start to change in the early 1970s, right? What we also see in 1973 is the founding of the Heritage Foundation. Right, which then feeds in a network of radio stations and television stations and young Republican clubs and more money being funneled into political campaigns and corporations that were previously scattered across the country, feeling like they had to set up offices in Washington, D.C. and hire law firms to lobby on their behalf. Right. This is all this insecurity, what academics call precarity, right? This precariousness that is now a defining characteristic for large numbers of Americans' lives.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's a feature, not a bug, right? This was the goal, right? And a precarious, insecure worker is a vulnerable worker and ultimately one who is cheap and easy to exploit. And that's all part of the intention.
So let me just point out another number, since you brought up when the Heritage Foundation was founded in 1973. The Heritage Foundation is the ones that are pushing out Project 2025. It turns out that every 4 years, the Heritage Foundation produces a document like this. So what you are saying about 73, I want people to know, Project 2025, you may be new to the
Reagan administration literally used the Heritage Foundation plan as its guidebook for the first term.
And I think it's really important, and I've been spending so much time, and I'll continue to spend so much time. It's a 900-page tome, everyone, but it literally dismantles every aspect of life, every aspect of life. And the most important thing is it doesn't require Donald Trump to get elected. So everyone thinks, oh, if we don't elect Donald Trump, all these things that we are reading about in Project 2025 won't come to fruition. And they're laughing because they say, really? Have you been to Texas? Have you been to Florida? Have you been to Oklahoma? Have you been to Iowa? Frankly, have you been to New Hampshire? Because guess what? They're initiating all those programs, all those policies in all those states. So again, you need to read the document because it isn't just a national document. It is actually designed for every state in America, and you are seeing it. And Lincoln, I was just laughing because I'm thinking about the fact that this is a feature, not a bug. This is all based on policy. And back in 2023, a year ago, I posted this on Facebook. For the GOP and their corporate backers, poverty is not a problem to be solved, but rather a condition to be maintained. Okay, that's what I wrote. I am apoplectic, but what is happening is not only are we seeing them that use wealth as a way of division, politics as a way of division, but now this gender thing that is now emerging, where we're seeing Black men, Hispanic men, white men suddenly seeing an affinity with this misogynist, lying, racist, two-timing individual who never paid his bills, who went bankrupt more than you could possibly imagine, who's never been a success, but has been an brilliant phony. They are turning to him as somehow part of a way to them assuage their anger, to sort of look to him for leadership. And then the resentment with women who suddenly see a policy prescription that so far go so far beyond. They don't just care about healthcare and abortion. They do care about the economy. They do care about infrastructure. They do care about what I used to call the soft economic conditions that ultimately define your life. But look at this division. And I don't know how you begin to repair that division in time for 2024. Will there be enough people that show up, both women and men who don't resent, in order to accomplish what we have to accomplish, which is to save democracy?
So there's a lot there. I would say the resentment, like the poverty, is not a bug. It's a feature. It's something to be maintained from their approach. I want to just highlight a couple things. First is that you talk about the Heritage Foundation in 1973. That was also the year Roe v. Wade was passed. 48 years later, Roe v. Wade was overturned.
Right.
The far right plays a long game, a long game. They see the drubbing of Barry Goldwater, and you've talked on this show, you got to lose until you win.
Right.
And they know that. And, you know, Barack Obama gets elected in 2008, and the transition kind of scrambles, right? There's no plan. There's no progressive vision. And that really is striking and hamstrung strings, even when we do get a president who has the best of intentions or has decent intentions. There's no plan. And part of that is because the right wing has completed its takeover, which began in the ashes of Barry Goldwater's defeat of the Republican Party. And after, you know, the parallel, then we might be having an earthquake in New York. I'm from San Francisco, so earthquakes are fine. I remember listening to the 1989 World Series on the radio when there was an earthquake.
Wow.
And now it's over. We're okay.
All right.
My building is still shaking.
Real? Are you serious?
Yeah, there was an earthquake here. Absolutely. I know from earthquakes.
Oh, well, we know we've had an earthquake in New Hampshire. Alexandra, I don't know where you live, but we're into the earthquake mode. All right. So it's short and brief. All right. Keep going. Yeah, after knowing what happened just recently, I'm like terrified, but keep going.
But after the McGovern drubbing of 72, the Democrats' answer was the Democratic Leadership Council, which was to move away from any kind of progressive vision for the party. I want to I'm consistently frustrated as a kind of analyst who spends too much time with data by some things that people have kind of accepted at face value about Trump. And one is that he's really radically reshaped the Republican coalition. The overwhelming majority of people who were old enough to vote in 2012 and who voted, if they voted for Romney, they ended up voting for Trump and all the way through. The switchers are, they're interesting, but they're smaller. And this data we're seeing about African-American and Latino men, and I don't like to use the word Latino men, the seeing Latinos as a voting block sheds more heat than light. It explains nothing. But let's see what happens when the election occurs. There is still some time. I suspect at the end of the day, the exit polls from 2024 won't look that different from 2020, 2016, 2012. And I want to make one other point. Obviously, they are dividing around issues like abortion rights, around issues LGBT rights. But the division is an ideological one, not a gender one. And to a great extent, the gender gap that we all learned about and the pundits talked about was a residue of mass incarceration. Because what it meant was that particularly the Black vote was so heavily female, because so many Black men were either in prison or otherwise lost their right to vote because of mass incarceration.
Right.
And because African-Americans were such a big Democratic voting bloc. So this notion that white women have been a majority big part of the Democratic coalition is simply never been true. When you break it down by race and gender, yes, white women tend to vote more Democratic than men, but not in massively significant numbers. And we should be aware of that. We all have lots and lots of different identities.
And I'm going to say something. I don't think we think that white women have been, you know, have embraced the Democratic Party. I think Black women have, but I don't believe white women have. But let me just say something. So, Alexander, we're going to go to you, but then we're going to go to a break, and then we'll come back to you. And that there was something that I just heard from Lincoln, and I'm going to suggest this. It's that Donald Trump has not changed the GOP. The GOP were able to use Donald Trump effectively, and especially more so now, to ultimately get to their goal. See, I think it was the reverse. I don't, you know, people are saying what Trump has done to change the GOP. And I think the GOP is grateful to Trump, because Trump ultimately, gave them license to do everything they want, from the courts, from tax policy, from deregulation, from everything you do. So it's not about Trump changing the GOP. It's the GOP being able to use Trump to accomplish their task. And we focus on Trump as the problem, as opposed to what is the underlying problem, which is the agenda of the GOP. That makes sense, Alexandria?
Yes, he's saying what the GOP has been thinking and supporting for years. So his racist rhetoric, that he is, you know, his violent rhetoric, all these, you know, extremist language that he uses is certainly reflective of the beliefs of many folks in this party. And he doesn't stop. If there was backlash to his rhetoric in this regard, from voters, we'd see it, but they're not. And so I think this is definitely his beliefs that he never sees consequences for very rarely is certainly reflective of where the party is right now and has been.
So when we come back, Alexandra, I want to go to Florida, because right now Florida has been at the front of so much of the conversation. Suddenly people are saying, oh my God, Florida could turn purple. What can we do here? They're looking at, you know, the two referendum, one on legalizing marijuana, the other one on protecting abortion. They're looking at all these different things and they're seeing this incredible opportunity. And frankly, I hate to break it to you, but the cost of insurance and the cost of housing and so many other things are making a tremendous amount of discontent in Florida. And I think to a large extent, and we have to talk about Florida, because actually Florida isn't a state in isolation. If you actually look, for example, at Texas, Texas actually parallels a lot of the same exact same sense of, you know, living with the GOP reality is very difficult. You know, it makes life very, very challenging. So when we come back, we're going to be continuing our conversation with Rethink the Week with Lincoln Mitchell, Stephen Pimper, and Alexandria Jacobson. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
This Civil Liberties Minute is about school dress codes, racism, and conformity. I'm Bill Newman. Texas, like about half the states, has a Crown Act. Crown, creating a respectful and open world for natural hair, a Texas law that prohibits discrimination based on hair texture or protective hairstyle commonly or historically associated with race. But the law hasn't protected 18-year-old Daryl George, who has locks, rope-like strands that he pins on his head in a barrel row, a protective hairstyle that reflects Black culture. Notwithstanding the Crown Act, the dress code in Daryl's high school in Mont Belvieu, Texas, prohibits hair that could extend beyond the top of a t-shirt collar. The fact that Daryl has never let his hair down in school was irrelevant. And recently, the state district court judge hearing the case agreed, ruling that because the Crown Act doesn't specifically mention hair length, the school could legally discipline Daryl as it has, including suspensions and relegating him to an off-campus disciplinary program because he wouldn't cut off his locks. What lesson should we learn from this school dispute? Well, the superintendent once explained his view that, quote, being an American requires conformity. There's another significant claim in the related federal case. Because the dress code targets Black male students, it violates federal civil rights law. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When
it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
This is how a heart breaks. This is how a heart breaks.
Hi, welcome back to the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What should we call it? We call it Rethink the Week. When did we record it? On Friday morning, when two of my guests were experiencing an earthquake because they both happened to land in New York City. And my understanding is from Stephanie, our producer, that it was 5.5 on the Richter scale. That is not small fry. And as Stephen Pimpera said, this is not a city that's been designed to withstand earthquakes. So this will be some kind of structural damage. So I just want people to sort of be aware of this. We're rejoined by Stephen Pimpera, professor of public policy at Vermont Law and Graduate School, Lincoln Mitchell, who teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University, and Alexandria Jacobson, an investigative reporter at Raw Story. So Alexandria, you sent us a piece, and it was a piece that was focused on sort of hypocrisy and Florida. It's like the two are like synonymous. Your piece was Florida Representative Ana Paulina Luna, very anti-abortion, and her husband sued the government over a vaccine mandate because they mistakenly believe that vaccines are made from stem cells from aborted babies. Boy, that's just ripe for a lawsuit, I'm sure. Yet, this is the kicker, they had stock in a company that actually uses stem cells. I mean, you can't make this up, Alexandra. I mean, it's just like, they don't give a crap about stem cells. They don't care. They just want to figure out whatever they can use to sort of market their political agenda. But I do think that story is kind of hilarious. And I'm just wondering, has it gotten any traction for that rep?
At Raw Story, we follow the stock trades of all members of Congress, and Representative Luna is just one of them. And lo and behold, earlier this year, she and her husband sold that exact stock in the stem cell company. So, you know, Representative Luna has been extremely vocal anti-abortion advocate. She has shown what she says are horrific images of late-term abortion fetuses on the House committee hearings. She's compared people that have used stem cells for, you know, research for debilitating diseases to Nazis, like extreme language. And her husband, essentially, her husband was in the Air National Guard. He declined the COVID-19 vaccine because they had this belief that
it was based
fetal
on stem
cells were used in the process of making the vaccines. And fetal stem cell lines are used in labs, but not aborted fetus cell lines, anything like that. So they're mistaken about it. They're suing the government. And then lo and behold, they have this stock in stem cell.
So, Stephen, the reason why I love Alexandria's story is that every 2 years, state reps run. And so all of a sudden, this story of hypocrisy, 4 or 5 years ago, people have said, it's just one thing in the portfolio. But given the fact that abortion and Dobbs and the referendum are so front and center, and we have the Florida Supreme Court doing that split decision, which is now going to initiate within the next couple of days, I guess not a couple of weeks, within 30 days, a 6-week abortion ban, which is basically an abortion ban. And we find out that 83,000 abortions took place in Florida last year because Florida and Virginia were like the only two places in the South where you could actually go to get an abortion. These kinds of stories that Raw Story did with Alexandria are suddenly actually very, very useful when you're looking at a November election that I'm going to be telling you in Texas, in Florida, maybe even in my state of New Hampshire, or frankly across the country. They're not going to be top-down elections, Stephen Pimpera. They're going to be bottom-up elections because I think people are going to suddenly see the consequences of what their state rep is going to be doing in the way of voting that affects their lives. They're going to be seeing exactly what the state Senate is going to do that affects their lives. And it's going to begin to trickle up because the damage is so intimate and so personal and so local in its effect.
And on the other side of the spectrum, it is going to make it enormously difficult for Donald Trump not to be talking about abortion and what national policy will look like if his party manages to regain the Senate and he is president. I think, I mean, again, look at the Heritage Foundation's blueprint. Right. There will, in fact, be a national abortion ban. And even if they don't win the trifecta, right, we clearly have at least two justices on the United States Supreme Court, as you observed in the poem to begin, who would be happy to use the executive branch to revive the Comstock law. And again, this is also outlined how you do this in the Heritage Foundation's playbook. Right.
Yes.
But it doesn't end there. This is part of the challenge, right? Because when you simply repeat the articulated plans of the party, people don't believe you. They think you're being hysterical because it is, in fact, so radical. But as we've seen, right, in vitro fertilization is on the list. Contraception itself is on the list. If you listen not only to the sort of the interest group forces on the right and elected representatives, but large segments of judges on federal courts, right? There is more and more sort of, at this point, shaded talk of fetal personhood. The idea at its most extreme, that life genuinely does begin at conception. That's when rights attach. And of course, in that world, those small group of cells have all the constitutional rights, but the woman who they inhabit has none. That is a clearly articulated goal of people with power and influence. And I think the challenge is, how do you communicate that in a way that it registers with people as a real threat, not merely some sort of partisan argument for political gain? I think that's really tough.
So, Lincoln, we've been starting to interview a woman named Ann Nelson, and she writes for the Washington Spectator. She is a phenomenon when it comes to sort of journalism and international journalism, and she's been focusing on Project 2025. But as I'm listening to Stephen Pimper, this is a quote from Ann Nelson that we have to somehow get people to understand. And here's what she writes. If there's anything the past 8 years have taught us about Trump, it is that the unimaginable is all too often achievable. Let me repeat that sentence, everyone. Please listen to these words. If there's anything the past 8 years have taught us about Trump, it is that the unimaginable is all too often achievable. And the reason I get so afraid, and the reason why I keep talking about the bottom-up election, is that one of the things that we learned from Project 2025 is they don't need Trump. In fact, where they're going is they're going hyper-local. And what do I mean by hyperlocal? They're encouraging a lot of their sort of supporters, whether it's governors like Abbott or DeSantis, or whether it's Young Americans for Freedom or Young Americans for Liberty or whatever the name of the shadow dark money group is. They are now looking at making sure not only do they win the November election, but they clean house in primaries. And what do I mean by that? I mean that they are looking in Republican primaries especially, and they're making sure that anything that has a rational policy, moderate, believe in any way, shape, or form that government has a role to play, they are being eliminated strategically in Republican primaries. And for a lot of gerrymandered districts, the only election of consequence is the primary. So they go where most people aren't even focusing. And they're spending, I was just talking to a guy who wrote a story about a tiny little race in New Hampshire. We have 400 legislators, Lincoln, 400. They get paid $100 a year. They represent a district that you could fit in your wallet. They're so tiny. And yet in this tiny little district, in this Republican primary, the one Republican thought, oh my God, look what I've done. I'm so successful. I've raised $30,000. But then the other dark money supported Republican ended up getting a check for $70,000. We've never seen money like that in a seat or ultimately a state rep race where he will only earn $100 a year and there are 400 of them. They know exactly what they're doing. And they're looking at a place that they can buy cheap and no one actually is really focusing on.
There's a few things there I'd like to address because this point of hyperlocal is extremely important. And I would give an example of the city of San Francisco, where in the last election, which occurred in March, right-wing money, from a lot of which are people coming from people who give a lot of money to very conservative Republicans, came in independent expenditures to take over the Democratic County Central Committee for the city and county of San Francisco, so that the majority on that committee are now people who were elected due to an enormous amount of right-wing money. And they will shift that city's politics leftward by supporting candidates who have the agenda of the tech billionaires and the real estate speculators. So this hyperlocal issue could not be more important. And it is not just in Republican areas. It is also in Democratic cities, because you can throw enough money and influence the outcome of a Democratic primary or a nonpartisan election. Keep an eye on San Francisco, because the progressive candidate that everyone was hoping will announce this Saturday, and the money and the vitriol against him will be extraordinary for a mayor's race. This notion that the unimaginable is achievable, I've used a phrase like that for years now, which is that the unimaginable, the distance between unimaginable and inevitable, is nothing. Something that seems unimaginable today, when it happens, everyone looks back and says, "Oh, it was inevitable." One macro example of that is the collapse of the Soviet Union. 1988, it was unimaginable. By 1992, everyone assumed it was inevitable. No, October 15th, 2016, everyone thought Trump's election was unimaginable. November 15th, 2016, those same pundits were writing about how it was inevitable. What Ms. Nelson's, or Professor Nelson, whatever the title is, point here is an important one. Because what happens here is that Stephen said something which, if you look at, I'm not picking on Stephen, but if you look at the publicly available information, seems to me to be absolutely right and very, very important. And if you say it, people will say, "Stephen, you're crazy. That can't possibly be true." I remember beginning in February 2017, I told a lot of people, and this isn't because I'm brilliant, because I don't think I necessarily am, but it's because I've done work in different parts of the world. I said, "Trump won't leave office if he loses. Here's why." I didn't tell this to right-wing Republicans because they didn't want to hear it, and I don't know that many of them. I told this to good liberal Democrats. Many didn't believe me, and many met me with anger. The reality of how bad this is so jarring that people don't want to hear it. The pundits and the centrists and the quote-unquote institutionalists will be saying, "It can't be this bad. The institutions will save us. What about the courts?" And they'll be building the camp somewhere. It is this bad. And the people who are refusing to admit it, they're the ones who are the problem, not the people who are trying to sound the alarm.
Alexandra, you were born in 1990. Is that what you told me? I think that's what you said, correct?
92, yeah.
92, okay. So, oh, good. The year I ran for governor, you were born. Such a double gift. I'm listening to all this, and I'm listening to the resentment, and people can't quite imagine. And I'm listening to this talk about how good the economy is, but people aren't feeling it. So I want to talk to you. And that is that when I use the word economy, I'm 70. So I am looking at, you know, what my job is, the value of my house, how much is a new car. When you're talking about the economy, are you looking at the climate crisis and your fear of the future? Are you looking at student debt and how do I pay it off? Are you looking at the cost of a new vehicle that's $45,000? Are you looking at the fact that you can't even afford the rent, let alone be able to afford a house? And I think that your perception of a conversation about the economy takes in so many things that I don't think we actually focus on, because too many old farts, 50 and older, are looking at an economy from an old traditional way, and they didn't have to sort of slice in the climate crisis. I mean, my youngest daughter said, "I am not having children because I'm not sure we're going to have a planet." That's a conversation I never had. Never, ever, ever. Now, I don't know if not having children is a function of how you talk about the economy, but I suspect that another reason why she's not having children is because of the cost of the economy and whether she can afford to raise a child, whether she can afford to do all these things. So I'm kind of curious, have anyone just sort of sat down with, you know, people under the age of 35 and said, when we talk about the economy, how do you process that conversation?
All those topics you just brought up are certainly part of the conversation, I'd say, for younger millennials, Gen Zs, for sure. The climate crisis is absolutely a big part of the consideration with having kids. In general, just the feeling of lack of financial security is just what it is the constant refrain we're hearing. So many people in my generation and younger feel like they can't buy a house. They have to have dual income to even consider affording that. The cost of childcare, all of these, you know, trying to pay down student loan debt. I mean, those, I think, are just the constant refrains that are shaping people's perceptions of the economy. And maybe part of the reason why Biden hasn't gotten the credit that, you know, the Democrats argue that he deserves for the growth and the great, you know,
so what would you want him to say? Like, well, no, Alexandria, what would you want him to say? You see, that's just give me again. If I keep hearing how good the economy is, I want to give him a knuckle sandwich. Okay, I'm just really ticked off. I look at the basket of food that people are spending and what they were spending in 2019 and what they are spending in 2024. And yeah, it may be less inflation, but the cost of my sugar went up. The cost of my eggs went up. I mean, and I'm looking at how I'm able to sort of feed my family now for $100 more a week, and they're not getting more food. So, I mean, I guess my question to you is, and I hate to put you on the spot, what is it that he would need to say that says he is understanding my struggle?
I think what younger millennials and Gen Zs want to hear is that there is this understanding of the cards are kind of stacked against us, it feels like, compared to other generations. And I think, you know, and what's going to be done to help alleviate those circumstances and make the economy feel more fair. And I think, you know, as we talk about the extreme rise in billionaires and just the extreme, you know, wealth gap in this country, it just leaves a lot of people feeling disenfranchised and frustrated about their lack of progress. So I think it's, you know, what's going to be done to kind of help level the playing field here so that, you know, the younger generations can kind of catch up to where others have. What others have achieved.
So the reason I asked that question of Alexandria, Stephen, is I knew I was going to you. And that is that I do think he has to recognize all those cards that are stacked up against them. And I think he needs to lift up all those cards and talk to them directly. Because it isn't just student loans, because that assumes that someone's going to college. Okay? And there's a lot of pissed off people who haven't gone to college and don't have student loans. So they're resenting that you're paying off their student loan, but they don't have the benefit of that loan. They still are not, you know, surviving. And what I'm trying to figure out is that I think elections are not only about how well have I done for you, go back 4 years, but what do I understand I need to do for you in the future? And I do think that what she said about all the cards stacked against them, I think he needs to lay those cards on the table and pick each one up and talk about them. Want to say, I see you, I hear it, and this is the policy change that is the only way to address this.
Here's the problem that I have with that. And if we go back to the pledge that he made in the previous campaign around student loan debt, right? He followed through, by and large, on what the campaign promised. And the fundamentally undemocratic political institutions that govern us would not permit him to follow through on that, I would argue, plainly legal plan. So we've got a mismatch, right? We've been talking a lot about the Heritage Foundation and sort of the 50-year, 60-year, 70-year mobilization that the right has taken on. And as Lincoln said, they've succeeded, right? So we've got institutions that were always undemocratic, right? They were, remember, built for property-owning, slave-owning white men, right? Literally, right? That's how the reason they built certain institutions in particular kinds of ways was to protect minority interests. And we have had an at least 50-year campaign to make those institutions even more minoritarian, right? This is another one of those that I struggle with. How do you communicate this to the public in a way that doesn't make them say, oh, okay, so you're telling me it's hopeless, why should I bother? Exactly. How do you turn that into something that starts to do that long-term mobilization to make those institutions more responsive to public will? One thing, and I've complained about this on this program before, Arnie, that I wish the Biden administration would do more of is defy those institutions at strategic moments, right? I would have loved the administration to say, I thank the United States Supreme Court for their opinion on our student loan plan. We disagree. They are not the only ones who get to interpret the Constitution. Me and the Department of Justice and all of our lawyers say that we can do this legally. I am therefore ordering the Department of Education to follow through on the plan. The Supreme Court has made their decision. Now let them enforce it.
We're going to end this conversation by going to what's happening in Gaza and the World Central Kitchen. So, Lincoln, I don't know what to do anymore. Words have no meaning to me. The only thing that I understand is death, because I'm seeing it everywhere. And I'm looking at not only the bodies piling up, and someone made an interesting comment the other day. They said, I think there's a the number is 33,000 who have died in Gaza. And they said that number is so probably not accurate, because both Bibi Netanyahu and Hamas want that number to be lower than it really is, because it's to their advantage, because it's about their agenda. And if the number is too high on either side, then they look even more horrific than the situation looks as we exist. And I'm looking at what's happening to Joe Biden, because even now we're even hearing that Joe Biden's wife is now telling him he needs to do something. I mean, this is like nuts. So I am just trying to figure out, how do we thread this needle? And I have people that are literally writing me saying, I cannot vote for Joe Biden because of his support of Bibi Netanyahu. And you know what my answer is, Lincoln? I said, well, here's how I decide. I look at electing Donald Trump, and I looking at electing Joe Biden, and I count the number of bodies that will result with that election. And there are more dead people with Donald Trump than there are with Joe Biden. And I don't just mean in Gaza. I mean everywhere, all right? And that is pathetic. It's not about the worst of two evils. It's about counting the number of bodies. So I guess I need to turn to you, Lincoln, and say, what the H does the U.S. do? And how do we initiate a policy? Because, you know, we need to, I mean, obviously they're unhappy in Israel, but Bibi needs to cling to this policy in order to stay in office. If Biden clings to this policy, he could lose his office.
I think you're absolutely right about the number of deaths. If you want genocide in Gaza, do what you can to get Donald Trump president, no matter what your view is. If you want to see more dead Gazans, you take your position and feel good about yourself and make Donald Trump president. I want to just push back on something you said that's very important. Large numbers of Gazan casualties are absolutely in Hamas's interests. That is why they did this attack on October 7th. We have heard a lot of talk about a ceasefire. I very much support a ceasefire. But in military terms, the proper demand here would be that Hamas surrender. Hamas started a war knowing what would happen. They have lost badly, and they are willing to have more and more Gazans die so that Israel's standing in the international community can decline. And I am in no way apologizing for Bibi. I've been critical of Bibi before a lot of these campus lefties knew who he was. But we have to tell some basic truths here. Another basic truth is that, according to the IDF, who I don't trust, 10,000 of those deaths are not civilians, they're soldiers. If we cut that number in half, which I am inclined to do, we have a ratio of about 6 civilian casualties to every one soldier. That is not, unfortunately, that out of line with what we've seen around the world. So there are some basic numbers here we have to understand. Another basic number here is that the real problem in Gaza that is going to cause the real genocide is the famine that is coming down the pike right now, unless the United States does something, not just the United States. I would point out that the United States and United Kingdom cut funding for the refugee agency. Note that there is exactly one refugee agency in the world that is still dealing with refugees from the 1940s, because in the rest of the world, those people are not considered refugees anymore. But there are other countries that could have given that money. No one said to China, a permanent member of the Security Council, or Russia, you can't give money to UNRWA. There's no one else was going to. Let me end here. Bibi and Biden had a phone call yesterday. I saw the readout of that phone call, and I said, that would have been great if it had happened on October 10th.
Yes.
But it happened in early April. Biden has been terrible here, not in his support for Israel, but in his support for Bibi, who wants nothing more than to see Donald Trump be president.
So there were
tough words yesterday. And the question for Biden is, will he back up those words with real actions? Because if not, he is only enabling Biden. And I would just say this, we have to say this because we don't say it enough. Hamas should release these hostages. Hamas committed a massacre. Hamas killed more Jews than on any day since the Holocaust, and did not kill a single soldier then. And I know that it's unpopular to say that.
I also want to remind you that Bibi Netanyahu had information that almost was precisely what they did. They did not respond within hours and hours to what happened here. You have to look at who was the accomplice to Hamas.
And we have to hold Hamas accountable.
I mean,
and of course, And all my Israeli friends will tell you that. But it is not okay to just ignore that and say, well, the dead Jews don't matter. The hostages don't matter. Hamas should have surrendered 2 months ago, and then this war doesn't happen. I mean, that's...
And Alexandria, I'm going to have to like end this conversation. Please, I apologize, but I want to read something from The Guardian. And Israel to reopen Erez crossing into Gaza after Biden sounds warning, okay? And it says, within hours of Biden threatening to suspend U.S. military aid to Israel, something that you just sort of mentioned, Lincoln, Netanyahu agrees to open a major crossing for humanitarian aid into northern Gaza, where starvation is widespread. Biden always had that leverage, but wouldn't use it. And that to me is the most devastating sentence. He always had that leverage, but didn't use it. So I need to thank all of you for joining us for this interesting Rethink the Week. I want to thank Lincoln Mitchell. I want to thank Stephen Pimper and Alexandria Jacobson for doing this. All right, everyone, we will schmooze tomorrow. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude, also known as Rethink the Week. You better-